News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The morning show is next.
And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm really happy to be speaking with Gwida Brown, who's been on the morning show any number of times in her capacity as Executive Director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. And I invited Gwida Brown to come on the program because I have read several different articles over the last couple of weeks that have brought up a point that I don't think would have otherwise ever occurred to me. And that is the fact that as all of us together experience the stresses and fears and deprivations that are part of this COVID-19 crisis, that a part of our population for whom we should probably be feeling kind of special concern right now are those struggling with addictions of one kind or another, and in particular, substance abuse of one kind or another, those addicted to perhaps alcohol or other drugs. And the fact that this is a situation that is probably fraught with all kinds of triggers that we need to be mindful of, and that people in this situation need to be very mindful of. And this, of course, is at a point in time when perhaps some of the standard resources and lines of communication and community that might serve people with this issue might not be in place or might be radically altered by this time of social distancing in which we find ourselves. So I thought Gwida Brown would be a great person to talk to in terms of, first of all, maybe confirming some of the concerns raised by some of these articles and getting her thoughts on what people with addiction issues can do to best function and survive this period, and maybe what we can do as people who perhaps care about them in a very direct way. Gwida Brown, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I really do appreciate it.
I suspect that you didn't need to have an article from Harvard Medical School or from any place else to have a heightened appreciation for the concerns that have been raised. Ahead of us talking about that, tell us what is happening with the Hope Council right now. To what extent are you still able to function during this COVID-19 crisis?
So we are seeing clients who have appointments with us for our intoxicated driver program assessments. There are some hoops they have to jump through before they can actually get an appointment that aren't as smooth. Normally they would come in, make the appointment, fill out the paperwork, pay us our money. But right now, because we're not allowing them to come in unless they actually have an appointment scheduled, the paperwork piece of it is a little trickier. And that's sort of the whole picture across the board. So people can get into treatment right now. It's just that process of getting into treatment is problematic. And so even our clients who are referring back out, their calls aren't being returned immediately, or they're not getting the answers they expect immediately. And it's not because there's not treatment available. It's because the systems aren't in place to move people through those lines quickly anymore. Whereas in the past, before COVID, those lines were open up much better. If you called a treatment facility, somebody answered the phone. Right now, people aren't answering the phone, and that's not to say that there's not treatment, because they are doing telehealth and they're getting people into their offices in different ways. But it really is quite a challenge and kind of eye opening to recognize how much we do things in person and expect people to just show up. So it's been interesting.
Maybe you could talk us through what the process was like by which you and others at the Hope Council grappled with what to do and when to do it and how to do it in terms of responding to this situation. I mean, first of all, do you recall what the first conversations were like when it first became apparent that COVID-19 was going to impact all of our lives in the direct way that it has?
Yeah, I think when the schools got shut down, and because this is sort of embedded in my memory, I have all these dates in my head. So on March 13th is when the schools were given notice that they had until that following Wednesday to close. And so we were open that whole next week, but it was under the understanding of we need to not see people. We need to figure this out. So we did stay open. We finished our appointments for that week through the 20th. And then we had time that week to reschedule everybody, thinking, okay, now we don't know what's going to happen. At this point, the governor hadn't made his safer at home proclamation, safer at home order. So we didn't know what that was going to look like. We had told everybody we'll be closed for about 2 weeks. We rescheduled the majority of our clients who had intoxicated driver programs. The people we see, we do groups. We had already canceled the groups. So we see people for the intoxicated driver program assessments, our other assessment programs, and then for drug testing. And so we had canceled all of those and rescheduled them for 2 weeks later. So the 2 weeks came and went, and other agencies were still seeing people, but they're doing it differently than I was comfortable with, quite honestly. So they're seeing them, they're doing phone interviews, and I don't think that that's a great means to get good information on our clients by talking to them just on the phone. A lot of confidentiality issues. Are they alone? Are they even them? So there are a lot of things that went into that. So we made the decision to reopen just seeing the clients as of a week ago Monday, just seeing people who had assessments with us or appointments made with us. And so I came in and I was seeing them by myself, going through that. Now some other coworkers have come in. The governor has deemed social service organizations essential. And so we're just taking all sorts of precautions, one of those being only the person with the appointment can come in. We wear masks. We clean everything up when people leave. We've told our clients you can't come in if you even sniffle. So we've really gone through a lot of hoops. Then our drug testing has still been put on hold because there's not a real safe way to do drug testing. You can't maintain a 6-foot barrier there. We're also getting back online to do phone calls with our clients just because of the reason of this interview, making sure people have the support that they need during this time. And so we're reaching out to them in their homes to just say, hey, are you doing okay? Are you still maintaining abstinence? Can we provide you any support? We've always had recovery coaches, and not always, but for the last several years, we've had recovery coaches, and their job is to, so what I always say, it's a sponsor without the emergent basis. And so they're not there 24 hours a day, but they're there to provide resources and filling gaps and help people to meet their own needs. And so that's what we're going to start doing immediately this week as well, just making those phone calls.
We're speaking with Gwida Brown, Executive Director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse, finding out right now to what extent the Hope Council is continuing to operate during this time of COVID-19 and the social distancing that we are all experiencing to various degrees. Gwida, as I touched on a little earlier, I suspect that you didn't need to be reading any articles to have it dawn on you that this is a time in which anybody who is already dealing with substance abuse or addiction and on the road to recovery are facing some very, very difficult days in which they are probably in situations in which there are all kinds of added stresses, perhaps triggers of one kind or another, that could make this a very challenging time to maintain sobriety or to continue on their road to recovery. First of all, as this COVID-19 situation descended, I wonder what kind of conversations you had at the Hope Council about exactly this, about how you could continue to serve your clients and what kind of special risks or difficulties they might be contending with.
You know, honestly, I wish I could say we were prescient enough to have those conversations, but we weren't. And I think that's probably the shame of it all across the board. I know that the governor in the Safer at Home order indicated that liquor stores were essential. And I have an issue with that for a couple of reasons. Pretty obvious reasons, but one of the concerns, and this is the rub. I don't think that they need to be essential in Wisconsin, but I don't know if they need to be essential in Kentucky or Ohio. In Wisconsin, we have really easy access to alcohol. And one of the concerns of keeping them essential was to make sure that people didn't go into withdrawals, that they didn't go into DTs and end up in the emergency rooms, filling up our emergency rooms with something that could have been managed a little bit better instead of the COVID cases. And so I get the rationale behind it, but I don't necessarily agree with it for Wisconsin. I believe that all of the Safer at Home orders are modeled after one another, and we just didn't need that out here in Wisconsin. And I think the message to that is alcohol is really important, and we should drink alcohol while we're cooped up. And that, of course, is a problem. But it's a problem twofold. So it's a problem you brought up about being in recovery and having all these triggers and not feeling like you can get through that. But the other thing is now you're locked up with people who might not have ever seen you at your worst. And given the circumstances, that's bringing out a lot of the concerns more than ever. You may very well be alone, and then not a ton has changed if that's the case. But if you're home with somebody who didn't realize how much you were drinking because you were out drinking or because you, whatever, there's a trigger there. There's a concern of the other person saying, hey, you're a wreck. So in Madison, and this was early on, probably 2 weeks ago already, there detox beds were already full because of people having to check in because of these concerns. And so it's not, you know, it's really easy to say people should just not drink or people should just drink reasonably. But we know that with the disease of addiction, that part of your brain gets turned off. You don't make good decisions. And given the isolation that's coming from this, it's that much harder. There are no groups. There are no 12-step meetings that you can go out and physically attend. And so the recovery community has done a great job of filling those gaps in with online groups, but it's still not the same. And people don't have that level of community. Every 6 months, something shows up on Facebook about how addiction is not a disease, but it's a lack of community. And every 6 months, somebody sends it to me and says, what do you think about this? And I say the same thing. It's a really nice answer, but it's much more complicated than that. But I think this is a great example of how it is a lack of community that drives people to use in excess. And it's a huge problem for the population that we're serving, and a huge population for, you know, a good number of people, 1 out of 8 people probably.
As you have continued to work with at least many of your clients albeit in, you know, maybe different fashion than has been the norm before COVID-19. Can you share anything that you have heard from some of your clients in terms of the heightened difficulty that COVID-19 is presenting to them?
Because I was doing assessments all of last week, and because I'm the one returning all of our phone calls, and today I had 21 messages to return, it's a lot. But the across the board, the concern is I can't get into treatment, or treatment shut down on me, and I was in treatment, and now I can't go. Now what am I supposed to do? And my answer to everybody is, you know, you still have to maintain abstinence. You still have to make sure you have community around you in any way, but I can't force people to do treatment for you. I can't force those organizations that were doing it to stay open and doing it the same way that we had been used to in the past. And again, because we're doing a lot of, not us, but a lot of the treatment providers are doing telehealth, and some people aren't comfortable with that. Some people just don't like it. Some people don't have the capacity to do it. So it's different. There are services available, but it is different. I know of a family member who started a 12-step meeting online, and she was really trying hard with it, and people were calling in. It was a Zoom call, and people were calling in and being really disruptive. So just from that perspective, she had 80 people on her call, and one or two disruptive people were ruining it for the other 78, which is not, it's just not something, if that would happen in a person-to-person meeting, it would get shut down immediately. It's unfortunate, not the meeting itself, but you get those people out of there. It's unfortunate that when you make allowances, things can go awry in a way that you didn't necessarily think that they would.
Wow. And particularly if you have maybe somebody hosting a meeting who is not aware of kind of the technical finer point, yep, of muting people's microphones and so on.
Yeah.
How that disruption could easily get out of hand and maybe even escalate in really unfortunate.
And that is huge. I mean, just the idea of, okay, you have to make this phone call. And then you have to, I mean, I know for me, Zoom has not been the blessing I suppose it should be. It's just hard, Greg. It's really hard. And it's hard for people who are not, you know, functioning at 100%. And I just think, wow, there are a lot of expectations that we're putting in people's way to say, what, you should be able to manage this. And it's like, I couldn't manage it on my best day, let alone now when I'm under pressure and I'm feeling this and I'm, you know, I'm scared and I'm losing my job or I'm losing my income or, you know, this. I had one client, I've had, you know, the gamut of clients who've been so angry with me up to one who said, I love you, because I had told him, you don't have to worry about getting in today. This is, you know, we're things are on hold. We're taking this slowly. We want to make sure everyone feels comfortable. And he's like, oh my God. He says, I haven't had a check for 2 weeks. I don't know how I'm going to pay you. I don't know, you know, what I'm going to do. And thanks for calling me back. I love you. Thanks for the information. I was like, well, thanks. That's one person who's not mad at me. So, but it is really tough. And it's, you know, we're talking about, should we change our paperwork system online? And we, right now you have to print out our paperwork and not print it out and then get it back to us. And so we're talking about, there are no libraries, so people can't go and fax. People can't go and print. I got some paperwork from a client that is in everything but black, so it's completely unlegible. I can't accept that. I have to get you to redo all of that. I talked to one lady who said, I don't have the internet on my phone. I don't have, she said, basically I have a telephone. That's all I've got. And, you know, I'm thinking, and yet we want people to do all of this other stuff, and it makes it really hard when there is no community, when you have to do all that stuff and then manage it from your own house. And it's really eye-opening. If nothing else, it's just really eye-opening.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very easy to make a lot of blithe assumptions about mm-hmm. kind of access essentially all people have to something like the internet. And all of this would be a lot easier if in fact that were the case, and it happens not to be the case. And if we set up all kinds of things, assuming that access to the internet is not a problem, we are bound to fail a whole lot of people that we would otherwise be wanting to help.
Exactly. And that's, unfortunately, a lot of those people are our clients. They're folks who, again, they're not functioning at 100% in the first place. And then our expectation is, but you have all this other stuff, right? And so when I call people, I have to say, do you use email? Do you use email? And do you have access to a printer? And, you know, it's things that no one has ever asked me. You know what I mean? Like, it's, well, you just print this out and you just do this and you do this. And it's like, yeah, it doesn't work that way for a lot of the population. It really doesn't. And again, these are folks who are used to supporting one another and getting support from other people. And now that support is completely gone. It's just what's in their house. And it's not necessarily good what's in the house. I've had a conversation once with Judge Wagner, and we were talking about how we are a society where if one piece of cake is good, two pieces are better, with the idea that we have people who will say to people who are in recovery, we have loved ones, family members, who will say to people in recovery, oh, come on, you weren't that bad, you can have a drink. And they're like, did you know me? Have you met me? I can't have a drink. And I think that's the other piece of this. So again, from the perspective of, well, liquor stores are essential. And if my drug of choice was anything but alcohol, if I were maybe a person who had been using heroin, it seems like liquor, alcohol, is okay. It's safe. It's legal. I don't have to worry about it because really I'm not using heroin. And that's not the case either. Addiction is addiction. It changes your brain across the board. So nobody is addicted to one substance. You're not addicted to alcohol, you don't have an addiction to alcohol, but not one to marijuana. You have an addiction, period. And I think that's the other piece of the problem here, is that the easy access to substances that people, especially to alcohol, but easy access to any substances that somebody would want in their homes, not necessarily getting the support that they need from loved ones, because the loved ones don't necessarily see it. You know, people who come from dysfunction aren't going to be able to say, oh, I'm going to help you stay sober. I'm going to help you stay off of those drugs. They're going to say, what I'm using, you might as well use too.
Wow. We're speaking with Gwida Brown, Executive Director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. So what would be some of the suggestions that you would have for somebody dealing with addiction, trying to maintain sobriety or trying to maintain their recovery under these current difficult situations? And one of the things I'm especially curious about is your suggestions for such a person when it comes to, first of all, the level of anxiety that so many of us are experiencing right now during COVID-19. To what extent does that tend to be a significant trigger? And would there be special measures that somebody with addiction should be practicing in order trying to keep their stresses and fears in check?
So we know that mindfulness makes a huge difference, being in the moment, paying attention to what's going on, and just gratitude. So starting now, keep a gratitude journal. Write down three things a day that you're grateful for. It helps you. It helps immensely. Everybody knows this, and people don't do it, and I don't understand why, but keeping a gratitude journal helps you to recognize and to focus on the good things. And so something as simple as just writing down three things a day is really life-changing. Staying in the moment, recognizing that this isn't going to last forever, it's hard. It's really hard to do that. I know it's hard for me, but again, in conjunction with that gratitude journal or even just journaling at all, it really helps to alleviate some of that anxiety. Because we don't have community in the typical sense that we're used to, it's easy for me to say, oh, just reach out to somebody. But we know that that's not easy to do. There's the online groups available. just connecting, even, you know, on Facebook, connecting with other people who are in recovery. There are so many groups out there and people who will uplift you in a really appropriate manner. Finding those people. Everybody has that one person in their life who's going to, well, I suppose most people have that one person in their life who will support them. Finding that person, reaching out to them by phone call and saying, hey, I'm struggling with this. I'm always amazed, Greg, that people will tell me, you know, I didn't know anything about addiction, and then I found out that my loved one was addicted, and so I talked to my other friend who doesn't know anything about addiction, and together we muddled through. And I was like, really? You didn't call us? You didn't call? You know, there are resources available out there, so reaching out for those resources. I know it's hard. I know it's especially hard when there's already anxiety at play, but those resources do exist, and we still do have help for folks. But yeah, it's a difficult time.
Right. So it sounds like one of your most basic bits of advice is that people should reach out to some of those sources and resources that have been there, which are still there, even if they are not there in the same way, or maybe to quite the same extent.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there are 12-step meetings online. So reaching out, you know, there are still sponsors available by phone call. And so reaching out for those folks, reaching out to the Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, finding their phone number in the phone book or online, and then just reaching out, and that's your first step. I mean, it really is, or your next step if that's what it has to be.
Very good. I'm sure you are really hoping for the day when a time of social distancing can be over. And I suspect that you and your staff are already thinking about how the Hope Council can move back to normalcy when it is determined that it is safe to do so.
We are. We're really worried about the clients. We don't want to cause more stress. And so we're sitting here figuring out ways that we can alleviate their stress. And they maybe don't know that. I'm getting a lot of phone calls of people just saying, hey, I'm just checking in. More phone calls than we've ever gotten. I'm just checking in. What's going on? I'm like, why are you've never called us before? Why is there a question now? But I get it. They don't know if everything they're doing is right and working towards their end goal, which is, you know, getting out of our supervision, essentially. And we're getting a lot of those phone calls. And then I think about all those people who aren't reaching out but still have those concerns, and then that heightened anxiety because of that. You know, I've got this going on, no one's calling me back, this is happening. And it's like, oh my gosh. And so I've had a couple of people who just say, oh, you know, yeah, that got taken care of. Thank you for calling me back, though. Because I think that's probably the biggest issue. We're not in the office. I mean, I'm in the office now, but across the board, no one's in the office and no one's answering those phone calls like they normally would. They're not, you don't call in and answer and then, you know, somebody picks up the phone anymore. So we have to get back to you. Because for us, I was gone for 4 days. I was, you know, the weekend, I was off on Good Friday. I was off yesterday. And so some people waited 4 days for me to call them back. And I'm sure that just is a huge amount of anxiety. And so we're really trying to alleviate that, but in the realm of COVID, it's not seamless. And so I get it. People are freaking out there, and you know, and I'm here answering their phone calls and things, and again, not answering the phone calls. I'm here returning the phone calls, and that's a problem.
Hmm. Well, we appreciate the diligence with which you're trying to do all you can with your clients. And we certainly hope anybody who happens to be listening to this who has particular concerns about their own situation or the situation of a loved one will reach out to the Hope Council for help. And you're advising patients.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And yes, I've gotten a few phone calls again since the beginning of this of, you know, my loved one needs help, this person needs help, what would you suggest I do? And we're not ignoring them. We're absolutely reaching out to them and giving them the support that we can. So, yeah, give us a call.
Guida Brown is the Executive Director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. Can you share the phone number for the Hope Council?
Sure. 262-658-8166. 262-658-8166.
Rita Brown, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and everybody at the Hope Council.
Thanks so much, Greg. We appreciate it.
And you're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two of today's program.
And now for part two of today's program today, I'm delighted to, in a sense, widen the canvas a little bit and speak today with Michael Mahoney, who is Director of Chicago Services for Hazelton Betty Ford. And of course, the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation is very, very well known when it comes to working with people struggling with addiction, people on the road to recovery. And we want to speak with Michael Mahoney not only about what Hazelton Betty Ford is continuing to offer through this COVID-19 crisis, but also to get his perspective on some of the special challenges that are confronting people in recovery, people struggling with addictions, even under the best of circumstances, as they now cope with these extraordinary circumstances under which all of us find ourselves. Michael Mahoney, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad that you can join us. Maybe right off the bat, you could sort of talk us through the process by which Hazelton Betty Ford, you and all your colleagues, began to come to grips with the reality that COVID-19 was going to impact you and what you offer to your clients. Take us inside that process by which you made the shift into this this new format.
Yeah, I'm the director of one site in Chicago, just outside of downtown Chicago. And my site is one of 18 different sites in the Hazelton Betty Ford organization. The headquarters is up in Minnesota, of course, outside of Minneapolis. And, you know, we first started hearing about the coronavirus and thinking about how it might impact our patients who are in our building. You know, we have intensive outpatient groups of all sorts. We have meetings in our building. We have hundreds of people coming through our building every day. And we were wondering how we were going to manage all that. And then as it got worse and worse, there was a crisis committee up in Minnesota kind of helping us direct things. And it became pretty clear pretty quickly that we were going to have to go to virtual services. And so the challenge then became how to transition from what we were doing in the building with all the face-to-face work we were doing into the virtual work, and how to develop a plan for getting it going. And it was very complicated.
How long a process are we talking about, and what can you tell us about that process of formulating that plan of attack?
Yeah, well, you know, Hazel and Betty Ford actually had some foresight in this. I don't think they foresee what this was, but in terms of the virtual services coming on board and how that might be something useful down the line. So they had some experience with piloting a program in San Diego, where there's a platform up and running, and they had some experience with that and some success going forward. So we used that as a model, and they launched into a big training effort throughout the whole organization to expose everybody to how the platform worked and how we would have to put it together and train our staff in order to get it out to be used by the community. And so that was a long process in terms of, not in terms of time really, but really, really in terms of intensity. I mean, there was just an intense effort over the course of a few days just to understand this and get it up and running. And there were challenges both with staff getting to learn it and also with the clients getting to learn it and accept it as a viable means of getting these sorts of services. There had to be acceptance on both sides. That was one of the biggest challenges.
So explain what your operation looks like right now and to what extent you are still offering just about everything that you were offering before COVID-19, albeit, I would assume, in very different fashion.
Yeah, why don't I'll talk about what we're doing locally, because most of our branches are obviously outside of Minnesota. So I think I can speak to most of those, and then I can tell you a little bit about Minnesota too. In Chicago, right now we do have a residence, and it's always been open to people in treatment, regardless of their level of care, regardless of their services. We've actually kept that open throughout this whole course of events. And we're proud of that. You know, it's a great opportunity for people to still come and separate themselves from some of the dangers that are out there. And so we've kept that going. But even for those folks who are in our residence, they're attending services virtually. So we're finding spots in the building where we can separate them and they can work independently within a group to obtain the services that we're providing. And then in addition to that, we have all of our groups going now. And our groups come in all kinds of different levels. You start with a very intense level, then down a step and down a step. But we're offering all those different levels of services, and they're all being offered virtually now, which means we have a group of about 12 people in any one group. The counselor can work from home now or in the office, depending upon their level of proficiency. And the clients, if they have the right equipment, there's not any problem. There have been some problems in terms of even when they have the equipment, they're getting to know how to use it for purposes of using doing these services. Because it's not as easy as it would seem. You know, you think about things like bandwidth in an apartment building in Chicago, for instance. Updating software on an iPad, for instance, was one of our problems. So there are all kinds of little tricky things like that that we had to overcome. And we're talking, we have 100 patients we're working with right now.
What would you say are the biggest differences between these kind of virtual meetings versus the more standard practice whereas you are all gathered in a single room, essentially face to face? I suspect that there is a mixture of kind of drawbacks and maybe potential enhancements to doing it in this way.
Yeah, you're right on the money there. I wanted to say also that up in Hazelden in Minneapolis, they still have all their residential services going there too. So in addition to the virtual things up there, they do have a residence. I wanted to mention that too, so everybody knows that. But in terms of some of the challenges, I think initially it was really getting buy-in on the part of the patients that this was really a way that could where services could be effectively delivered. Like you really could have a group that could be effective, and you could connect with each other in this sort of a way. And we've had a couple of counselors and a lot of the actual patients tell us that they prefer this method. And I was really surprised to see that myself. They think that they get more attention this way and that they can zoom in and zero in on each other as they're talking, read facial expressions and connect in all kinds of ways that they hadn't been connecting before. I've got to tell you, I've been surprised by it too. It's really shocked me what a great thing it is.
What would you say is the level of concern about those who have not come aboard in this new format? Are we talking about significant numbers of your clients that, for whatever reason, seem to have fallen away from whatever programs they were part of? Or by and large, are just about everybody taking part in this sort of new way of doing things?
Yeah. Within the Hazelden organization, we had a transfer about 1,500 clients throughout the whole organization. Some of them were reluctant and they didn't want to do it. Other people right now, my main concern is because most of the people we asked to switch over did. They were cooperative. They've given it a try, and I think with most of them, it's been successful. I think the challenge right now is for the people who weren't in treatment when this happened, who are at home now with their families, who are in trouble right now. But there aren't consequences right now. They're at home and they're comfortable. And what's going to happen when all this lets up and they're out in the real world and all these challenges confront them again? I think we're going to see a lot of things unleashed at that point in time. And that's my real concern right now.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Michael Mahoney. He is with the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation, part of their Chicago operation. And again, I think you said earlier that there are actually 18 different sites in and around Chicago area in which Hazelden Betty Ford offers its services.
Throughout the country.
Oh, throughout the country. Great. So tell us about what you see as some of the most serious areas of concern in terms of what we are experiencing in this time of social distancing when it comes to somebody who is struggling with addiction and or on the road to recovery. What about this current situation could perhaps lead to somebody getting into new trouble or falling back into old trouble?
Sure.
maybe some of the triggers that are maybe part of this scenario and what we can do about that.
Well, you know, even before this happened, all this started, the biggest triggers going into treatment are things like financial concerns, jobs, family relationships, those sorts of things. And my big fear is that those sorts of triggers are going to become even bigger. They're going to be even magnified, and they're going to be more of them. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen anything like this, where we've had 22 million people in the country lose their jobs all at once like that. And the financial toll it must be taking on families right now, and the worry that they have. I think about the anxiety they're experiencing, the fears, the apprehension about not knowing what's ahead for them. I think about people who are older, who had their retirements all planned and laid out, and now those things have been upended. So a lot of the different plans and the anxiety that goes along with all those things require all kinds of different services. And I'm hoping that we have enough providers to care for all that, because it's going to be overwhelming, I think. I think one of the things in substance use treatment that's developed over the last 10 or 20 years is co-occurring disorders. And those are disorders that happen when you're struggling with a substance of some kind, like alcohol or heroin or something like that. And then you're also at the same time struggling with anxiety or depression, and you have to manage those both at the same time. I see a lot of that happening, and a lot of that we're going to have to address as we come out of this and as we're dealing with all the challenges people are facing. I just think all those things are going to be magnified.
Do you see the typical person struggling with addiction having trouble just being cooped up? Does that in and of itself, being relatively stationary, having rather limited options in terms of just getting out, is that a positive or a negative for the typical addict, or is that maybe difficult to generalize?
That's an absolute negative. One of the things we see all the time is with people who struggle with drugs and alcohol is isolation. We encourage people not to isolate, because when they isolate, they're not engaged with other people. They're thinking inwardly. They're thinking a lot of depressed thoughts come in when you're isolating. So we encourage people to get out and meet with people in all kinds of different forums. We talk about engagement all the time. If you can maximize engagement in a number of different ways, you maximize your opportunities for recovery. So we're talking about going to treatment itself. We're talking about going to 12-step meetings, a meeting with a therapist, meeting with your family, all those sorts of engagements where you get out and you're meeting with people and you're actually interacting in society. Those are all healthy things that really help people struggling with addiction. And those are the things that we're concerned about right now, because that's the opposite. I mean, that is social involvement, and we're talking about social distancing. So what we're trying to do is facilitate social interaction virtually. And I think it really can help. And I think we're bringing people together in all kinds of ways that we never would have envisioned. You know, I think even encouraging patients to get together with their families on Zoom and things like that. We see a lot of that right now, family celebrations, daily meetings with families, that sort of engagement. It's really positive, and we have to encourage people who are struggling to really start engaging in those kinds of things, in addition to all the professional things we've been talking about.
How is the matter of stress and fear best handled by someone, apart from what we've already talked about in terms of connecting with other people? Do you think for people struggling with addiction, there are particular strategies that can be most helpful for them to, if not keep their fears at bay, at least keep their fears and anxiety in sort of proper perspective, so it doesn't become a very, very serious problem for them?
Yeah, there are a number of different psychotherapeutic modalities to deal with fears and anxieties. Therapists have their own methods of treatment, but I think it's important for people who really have those sorts of problems to seek out individual therapy in addition to whatever group work they might be doing in addiction, because I think those individual therapists can provide the tools that are necessary to help deal with some of those fears and some of those anxieties that people are going to be experiencing. And I think it's, like I was saying before, that co-occurring part of things, part of dealing with co-occurring disorders might be very well having an individual therapist to work through fears and anxieties with this, with the types of tools that have been proven to be effective. And there are all sorts of them. I mean, I could list them, you know.
Tell us what life is like in Chicago right now. Of course, one of the great cities of the country, but we're seeing, of course, that it is the major cities that are feeling the brunt of COVID-19 in so many different ways, and Chicago is no exception. How would you characterize, particularly in terms of what you're hearing from your clients, what is life like in Chicago right now with COVID-19?
Well, you know, it's funny. My universe of people has shrunk to about 10 people, I think, going back and forth from work. That's about it. I feel very fortunate to be able to interact with my coworkers and with the patients, because it does keep me occupied and give me things to do, and I feel very fortunate about that. But I'm amazed by the attitude that I'm seeing. You know, I really am, not just with Hazelden employees, but the patients too. There's a real sort of optimism, I think, about things right now. I don't know why that is. There really is a sense of optimism in the groups that I'm seeing, where I'm seeing interaction, where I'm seeing engagement. Because I'm coming in the morning and I take the Kennedy into work, and it's the fastest I've ever gotten to work. You know, it takes me 10 or 15 minutes from the suburbs, and it used to take me an hour. But, you know, nobody's out there. Parking is a breeze, all these different sorts of things, and it's sort of like a ghost town. But then I get into work, I open the doors, I come in, and I engage with people, and there's this feeling we're all in the same boat. You know, we're all struggling the same ways, we're all experiencing the same challenges right now, and there's a real desire, I think, on the part of people who I'm seeing in the workplace and the patients who are struggling, to come together and work on this together to solve the problem. It's been very impressive. It really has been.
I'm glad to hear that. If people want to get more information about Betty Ford Hazelton and all that you offer, what's the best thing for them to do?
Well, there are a few different ways. One is just call the 800 number, 1-800-I-DO-CARE, and that will open up a whole smorgasbord of resources in that way. The other easy way is to go online, and there are a couple different things to do there. HazeldenBettyFord.org is the main website that leads you to all sorts of different resources. But there's a special one too called the DailyPledge.org, which is really a great thing for people who want to attend 12-step meetings. Because within that website itself, the DailyPledge.org, I think we have 30 different 12-step meetings that are up now, where people can go in and they can get signed up, and then they can start attending some of those meetings virtually, and they can see the sorts of things that I'm talking about right now. And how effective it is, and what a positive thing it could be in their lives.
Very good. Michael Mahoney is with the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation, their operation in Chicago. Michael Mahoney, I appreciate you joining us today, and commend you and all of your colleagues for the good work that you are doing on behalf of your clients, and wish you well. And thanks again for being part of the morning show today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation with Dr. Jonathan Shaler, who is a professor of communications at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We'll be talking with him not only about what it's been like to move his teaching to an online format, as have just about all educators across the country, but we'll also talk with him about a really remarkable project which he helped to create, a project in which he and a number of his colleagues from the Shakespeare in Prisons Network collaborated online in a performance of a Shakespeare play. And it was such a success that they have gone on to do a second performance and are going to be doing more over the next several weeks. We're going to hear all about that. On Thursday's morning show, we'll be joined by Gateway Technical College President Brian Albrecht to learn the most recent news about Gateway's response to the COVID crisis. And on Friday, two author interviews, including one with Tom Clavin, author of a wonderful new book called Tombstone, which tells the in-depth story of the OK Corral. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. We're approaching 9 o'clock.